Good evening. My name's Jane Lomax-Smith, and I welcome you to the Friends of the Library's first of programme of the year. I'm really excited to acknowledge that, firstly, we've got the Wakefield support this year, and just to remind you that you should always buy Wakefield books. They're a gem in our country, and if you don't keep buying their books, they won't survive, so please buy your books. They will come for each session, and they have donated some gift tokens for us as well, so that's just fabulous. They happen to be Stephen Orr's publisher, and I think that we've managed to get their best writer of their whole suite here. To start off the year's programme. And I can see he's blushing. But from canvassing the room, it's apparent to me that there are several people here who've read all of his books, and you wait excitedly till they're published. And that's because I think he speaks to South Australians, and there are stories that we can dream of and imagine. There's one word that I've always thought about that I've never actually managed to weave into a sentence, so I'm just going to say this word. It's like a palimpsest. Isn't that a wonderful word? Mm. Never managed to say it before. Because his stories have shadows of things we remember half from history. He's been he's at the moment on the long list for the Miles Franklin, and we think he deserves to win. He's got an opera about to be produced, and he writes all these amazing books whilst working as a teacher. He is a great South Australian author, and I'm very delighted that he's here today to speak to us. Stephen.
Thank you very much. Good. Thanks for coming. I go to Writers Week occasionally, and I really love certain writers. And I sit there for half an hour, and it just flags. It's like, oh, I thought you were so wonderful. And half an hour later, you think, oh, God, they're just human. They're just as ordinary as me, just as uninteresting and unfunny. So I really hope that doesn't happen. And if it does, this could be the first and last time you have to put up with me. So anyway. So I'm going to do a little bit of a journey over the books I've written and maybe do one or two readings. I was going to photocopy the excerpts and I forgot to, so I'm going to have to read from the book, so it could get a bit clumsy, so just bear with me. I am slightly incoherent at the best of times. I teach, and I've found out that's the best way with students. They like a bit of incoherence in their teachers. The ones that actually are too smooth, you can't really rely on, so... So I'll read, I'll talk, and I'll read some excerpts. There was going to be a slideshow behind me, but that's also didn't quite make it in time. Anyway, so I'll start off, and at the end I'll take a few questions, and we'll see how we go from there. And, oh, by the way, thanks for coming, because I know, you know, at night time, it's a lot of you, public transport, cars, parking, etc. So thanks for coming. So I first came to the Bar Smith 20 years ago. I sat in a corner somewhere. I admired the spray-on concrete ceiling and the flickering lights. This doesn't have, but if you go down a level, there is spray-on concrete ceiling. It's beautiful. The no-talking signs that most people ignored. Eventually, I sharpened my pencil and began. What might have been a career, although it's mostly felt like a hobby, what might have been the great Australian novel, although the remaindered fragments of the 2000 Vogel runner-up, attempts to draw Jesus, are scattered far and wide. The pages yellow, the glue fails, the spines crack. You find a copy inscribed at the Port Dock Market for $3 or negotiable. And there's also, the other day I found a couple of copies at the Animal Welfare Bookshop, brand new. No one had read them. Signs, so they'd gone straight as a present, straight to. In a 1992 essay, the late, great Bob Ellis, who, by the way, I feel, walking through the city today, I feel I'm starting to resemble in terms of walking around with this. In a 1992 essay, the late, great Bob Ellis described the near impossibility of making a living in Australia as a writer. That's what's rewarded financially is generally the dumbest sort of writing, was what he was essentially saying. I'm just going to read a few words from the late, great Mr. Ellis. He talks about trying to make money as a writer. He says, for a learned book review that takes 4 days to conceive and write in the Herald, or say, the Adelaide Review, you might get $150. For additional dialogue that takes 4 days on an abomination like Birdsville, which I think was a film or a miniseries, I can't remember, he might, as I did, get $15,000 or three quarters of a full year's literary grant to write a novel. For a classic theatre play like A Hard God or No Room for Dreamers, one that takes a year and your life's blood, you might get $400, and as did Peter Kenner, an abusive eviction from the theatre. Thus, it is our finest writers like Oakley, Morehouse and Carey and Lurie who go whoring after films and waste replaceless years and all the words they might have put together trying to make the one big killing that will keep them in Greek lunches and typewriter ribbon for a couple of years of impoverished pecking away at probable masterpieces. They pretty well always fail, not so much because they don't know the medium, because they're often very good at it, but because the medium is run by illiterates who fear the brain power of rightly famous men and don't like looking like goats in front of the film crew. So that was his summary on making money. But even more depressing was a tryst with television. I have to read you, this is quite funny. This is when he, as you know, many of you know, Ellis spent a lot of time writing films that didn't get made. Also television. He says, series television has the obverse side of too little space or too few actors. It has instead of too much time. I remember once when the usual 12 lunatics foregathered around the prawn crackers and beer to plan the next 10 episodes of Certain Women. Does anyone remember Certain Women? Okay. Glyn Davies, the grizzled old Welsh ex-walloper, inexplicably in charge of this penetrating weekly insight into Australian women, said, "Now, in your 45-minute episode, Bob, the car gets stolen." After a stunned pause, I tried to cheer myself up. "Oh, that's fine, Glyn. We have the police investigator, the possible suspects." "No, no, no," said Glyn. "Next week the police investigate. This week the car gets stolen and the owners react." "Ah," I said, "right, right, right. Yes, my God, the car's been stolen. Perhaps we should take the bus." He used a quote from his best mate Les Murray, one of my favourite poets and probably yours. He used a quote from Les Murray to conclude about the process of being a writer in Australia. He said, Les Murray, that is, "I have formed the opinion, after years of research and further years of agonising reappraisal, that taking one thing with another and not leaving out the necessary reverence and the necessary hindsight, that all in all, and for better or worse, Australia may well be a lemon." That was his conclusion then. It's a little gloomy, but anyway. Henry Lawson formed similar opinions after a life of trying to write in Australia. His advice to Australian writers was to, quote, "study elementary anatomy, especially as it applies to the cranium, and then shoot yourself carefully with the aid of a looking glass." 90 years later, George Johnson felt the same way. Living on the Greek island of Hydra in 1958, he explained his and Charmaine's Cliff's combined income of £125, quote, "comes from 5 books in circulation or accepted, 2 foreign translations, 1 sale of foreign serial rights, an earlier novel, and certain magazine extracts. For this and all the work it represents, the return, I'm sure you'll agree, is hardly worthwhile." That was 1958. "Hardly worthwhile, but," he explained, "I have all sorts of writing plans and shall probably go on producing a novel a year for many years to come. This, as all writers know, is the curse of perpetual frustration." He explained it away by saying, quote, "I have, you see, enough confidence in myself at least." And you need it to be a writer. Back to the Barsmith here. 2 levels below here. The Terrazzo Dunnies with their outstanding graffiti. Phil Grammett, a character in my second published book, Hill of Grace, studies pharmacology at Adelaide University, but he has a bent for other things. This includes perfecting his poetic gifts on the Dunny walls. He's a sort of budget Banksy. Someone drills holes in these walls, just enough to cop an eyeful, but Phil writes messages like, "not recommended for children," or insert here. He adds the predictable, "arts degrees, please take a single sheet above the bog paper, and try some Eliot on the back of the door. We shall never cease from exploring," and he doesn't, ending up at Mount Crawford vomiting mushrooms he mistakes for the magic variety. The Barsmith has changed. I spent hours watching flies trying to escape from cobwebs, the spider emerging the world of natural selection as my fiction went unwritten. I wrote my first 5 books here, longhand, clearing my throat when people talked and the librarians didn't spring to life, jumping on the miscreants like an elite SS troop. Eventually I'd give up and move, throwing an angry glance, not that anyone cared. Silence, I think, is the most valuable thing of all, up there with love, wisdom, and unexpected sunburst. I loved the Bar Smith's retro 50s feel, although it wasn't actually retro. The desks, the chairs, the Khrushchev... The Khrushchev-era windows. The idea that a million people had written a million books about a million topics, and if I had time, I could explore them all. That's always what's excited me, the potential to know. I could never understand sport. You only ever had the potential to kick a bit further, run a bit faster. So what? So I'd sit there for an hour after I'd finished writing, looking through maths texts, wondering why I was looking through maths texts, reading a history of sans-serif types or Napoleon III's Paris. The same thing I did as a kid at school. The grass was always green, but if you got to the early to the library early enough and got a copy of Asterix, your lunch would be bearable. That's why libraries matter, why the Bar Smith matters. All of this knowledge is held in trust for our great grandkids. I hope the book remains the heavy, smelly paper types. I hope someone doesn't come in, digitise them, and then arrange a book burning on the Bar Smith lawns. I think Google has something similar in mind. I think it's called Watson. Has anyone heard of Watson? It's essentially Google taking free content, digitising it, and making money out of it. Pardon me. I think Google has something in mind, or maybe others, the advertiser. Winston, is there any journalist here tonight? This will get hairy before it finishes, ladies and gentlemen. Or maybe others, the advertiser, Winston Smith, snipping away at the truth, producing a worldview pleasing to the North Terrace mob. So now you're saying, my, he's a bit angry, isn't he? To which I reply, moi? Problem being, speaking writers, it seems, are meant to entertain audiences these days. I prefer to terrify. And this, at this, Patrick White was the best. If I can share a quote from 1988, White said, "The bicentennial circus tends to hide us from the fact that we are no longer a democracy. We are a country run by and for millionaires and a prime minister who toadies to them." Seems strangely familiar. Or, he said, "In a society where there has been such a serious lapse in integrity, our politicians' attitude to uranium isn't surprising. I wonder what he'd make of Kimber, glowing with golden wheat, sheep and other things." But don't worry, I'll calm down. I've been invited to talk about my book, so I will. There were two juvenile attempts at a novel, Best Forgotten. Then, in late 1995, I came here and rewrote my 1993 play about the disappearance of two jackaroos in the Great Sandy Desert in 1987. The play had been an experimental verse number I'd written and directed for the Walkerville Village Players. Did anyone see any of their plays? Oh, they were classics. They were classics. Peter Gers had come, liked it, especially when one of the jackaroos pointed a rifle at him and called, "It's Lenny the Emu." He hadn't liked my first play, Vocations, which was at the Odeon Theatre Norwood in 1990, believe it or not, anywhere near as much, stating in his review, quote, "This play doesn't need a doctor as much as a hospital." Not to be put off, in the best George Johnson tradition, I just kept going, despite all the evidence suggesting I was flogging an extremely dead horse. I managed several drafts, moved to Queensland to work, sent the novel to every publisher in Australia, and received the predictable rejections, probably from the work experience kids they'd got to read them. It's true, they do that, by the way. I thought, and still do, whether I was and am not so much a proper writer, i.e. went to university and learned how to do it properly, so much as a tinkler, like Wayne Davies, who lived across the road when I was a kid, always fixing up someone's old Datsun, although they continued blowing smoke and sounding like Norm Davies. Pardon me, my voice is cracking. Puberty has arrived at last. Thank you. Down the road. Norm Davies' hour of Winnie Blue-inspired coughing every morning. Maybe you can never properly fit an air filter unless you've been taught how. Not to be put off, I wrote another experimental novel, A History of Lavender, still looking for a publisher. This one concerned a mother and her son living on a weed-infested ex-cattle empire. She writing a tract on rare lavenders, he rehearsing to be Christ in the local mission's Passion. The book had song lyrics, play script, scraps of instructions from tractor manuals, you name it. I thought it brilliant. But again, most publishers didn't. Maybe I was ahead of my time. The yellowing manuscript in my wardrobe still awaits its discovery at the hands of a local Sylvia Beach, if such a person exists anymore. Not to be put off, I tried again, third time lucky. pardon me. This was the one that would make my name. The story of William Miller, religious eccentric, who studied the Bible and decided the world would end on 21st of March 1844. I reset my story in the Barossa Valley of the 1950s and turned William into a Lutheran elder. The book was published by the esteemed Bolan Press in 2004. Is Michael here yet or not? No, he's out there. The esteemed Bolan Press, as I call it. I was summoned to an author event at Peter Lehman's winery soon after, full of Lutherans, chin whiskers everywhere. 10 minutes in, one stood and said, "What right have you got talking about what you don't understand?" The well-lubricated crowd came in on my side, telling him to sit down. But he continued, as did I, pointing out that it was ironic, wasn't it, that I came all this way to see my novel brought to life. He didn't get it, grumbled, sat down and expected me to continue, although I didn't, said I'd had enough and got stuck into the free wine. So if this ends badly, and I walk over there. Sorry. This was my introduction to the power of words and ideas. I'd always thought I was entitled to say what I want, offend those requiring it, upset those whose worldview had been formed by 2.5 men. But here I was, staring down the first of many of the easily offended. Not even that. Those who are so unsure of their position, they seek to defend it with muscle and whisker. But for a moment, I was Patrick White, saying it as I saw it, something it seems to me too few writers are willing to do these days, to which I will digress onto a brief reading from Hill of Grace. It looks like this, if you want to buy a copy. This describes William, who's now decided that the world is about to end. He's converted many of his neighbours to his worldview, their children, and they're waiting for the end to come. He sees it as his job to persuade his neighbours to the same point of view. So he goes walking. In mid-December, as most of the valley folk were harvesting pines and pickling pig for Christmas, William continued his program of door knocking. On a bright, clear blue sky Tuesday, as the sun warmed the footpaths of Munsburg Court, he walked along in polished black shoes, real leather soles taking the heat up into his feet. Every step was a step closer. Aching corns and doors slammed in his face were a sure sign of salvation. He wore his father's grey suit and a tie bloomer his wife had bought him for their anniversary. Which one, he thought, wood, tin, opal? It was before the war, but after the worst of the Depression. Time was like that, blurring in giant swathes, a million little memories transforming into one, small victories inflating like a prized pumpkin at the Tanunda show. He opened a gate and navigated a weedy yard, tapping on a fly-screen door, which was mostly all holes. "Hello," he called softly down the hallway. "That you, Sue?" "No, my name is William Miller. I was wondering if I could talk." He heard furniture shifting and a kettle whistling, the clang of metal and then silence. A budgie hanging on the front porch flitted around its cage trying to escape the sun. William took it down and placed it in the shade. "Hello, I'm coming. Is it important?" "Yes." "You're after money?" "No." William sat down on a petrol drum and waited. Time was on his side. Further up the street, Joshua Hines stopped, looked at a piece of paper and saying to his youngest son, "Two more streets, if not we go home." "Dad, two." They kept walking, Joshua tapping his pipe on the sole of his shoe, walking, tapping, almost tripping over. William stood up. "Joshua! William!" As the Hineses joined him on the porch, William set to straightening the young boy's tie. "Joshua, you told me 1 o'clock. I would have been. I was stood up. They figure I need their business. You watch. Tomorrow there'll be a phone call." He sighed. "What you waiting for?" William called down the hall. "Hello? Hold on." And then came the sound of hammering. Joshua looked at his son. "Don't be so glum. What are we here for?" "Jesus. And what's he going to do?" "Save us." Joshua spat on a hanky and wiped the boy's face. "You tell people." The door nudged open. A man of about 60, wearing a singlet and stooping so much he strained his neck to look up at them, shuffled out to the porch and squinted. "Haven't done a fucking thing with this yard. Apologise for the mess." With his eyes adjusted, he looked at Joshua and said, "Didn't you sell me a car once?" "No, maybe it was some insurance." "Maybe. You up to date?" The man laughed and smoothed his singlet down over his belly. "You got to be kidding. Does it look like I got insurance?" Taking a moment to look them over, he continued. "That what you're here for?" William stepped forward. "No, we've come to talk about Jesus." "Jeez, don't know what's worse. What's a kiddie for? You lot always bring your kiddies. Think we might feel sorry for you." The man walked down the front steps and into his garden, bending over to pull a thistle. He nearly fell over. Joshua took him by the arm and he became defensive. "Get off. Done all right without you lot up to now. Always round when you're not wanted, never when you're needed." Joshua smiled. "Mr. Grosser." But Albert Grosser was bending over to the little boy. You talk, or you're just for show? Joshua's son stepped back and caught himself on the roses. As he untangled himself, he said, next March, on the 21st, the Bible says these days will come to an end. What days? Joshua stepped forward. Mr. Grosser, I remember I insured your house for fire, and it didn't burn down. It might have. Do I get my money back? William pursued him through a hedge of rosemary. Mr. Grosser, Jesus Christ is your insurance. Spare me. Do you deny the truth of Revelations, of the Bible itself? All I know is you lot are never around when you're needed, just when a man's trying to take a piss. He looked up at William. I got a bit of paper in me box, yeah? You're an idiot. Joshua looked at him, picking the dead heads off the carnations, which were nearly dead themselves. Albert, it's my house. William asked him why he was so angry, and that's all it took. Albert was off, telling them about the orphanage at Goodwood and the Maris brothers with their God is Love and their bamboo canes. He showed them an article he kept in his wallet, stolen from the State Library reading room, yellowing and broken, where it was folded, dated September 1893 and entitled Baby Deserted. It told the story of how an unidentified mother had abandoned her baby on the floor of the ladies' lavatory at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, a small hairless male done up in a dress and wrapped in a shawl. And beside him, neatly folded, a pile of new clothes for a baby girl. Albert claimed he could still remember the smell of the polished floors. So that was William Miller. Pardon me. I got to keep drinking. Writers do get nervous, and you are very intimidating human beings looking at me. And if you think about it, writers really have nowhere to go. We're just here. And we can't go. And I did actually do a speech once early on where I got nervous enough, because I'm not a good public speaker. I got nervous enough and my mouth completely dried and my tongue cleaved biblically to the top of my mouth. And I had to wait in front of a group like this while someone went and got me a glass of water. And it was probably the longest 3 to 4 minutes of my life. So bear with me. At least I'm honest, aren't I? Where was I? Okay, not to be put off. We're going back to my writing now. I tried, third time lucky. By the way, if I go over, tell me to stop and I'll stop. Not to be put off, I tried again, third time lucky. Oh, I've just read that, haven't I? Sorry. This was my introduction to the power of words and ideas. Reading digression. I have an Ern Malley poem. I had often cowled in the slumberous heavy air, closed my inanimate lids to find it real, as I knew it would be, the colourful spires and painted roofs, the high snows glimpsed at the back, all reversed in quiet reflecting waters, not knowing then that Jura perceived it too. Does anyone know that poem? A poem written by Howe Stewart and Jim McCauley, or should I say Ern Malley, in the early 1940s. Both poets determined to debunk the scourge of modernist poetry. And a quote from one of the poems that Macaulay and Stewart wrote was, in the 25th year of my age, I find myself to be a dromedary. They wanted to fool Max Harris, whose ghost still haunts the Ira Raymond room. He is in here. Max, welcome, come in. He was the editor of the terribly out there journal Angry Penguins. Firstly, let me say, I actually love these poems as poems, which seems to suggest that time smooths all creases. But it does seem strange now that Stewart and Macaulay would go to so much trouble to make their point. As writers, if we're any good, we get the last word, which is some consolation. I still maintain that writers should be shit stirrers. Now, people say you've got a chip on your shoulder, but it's not that at all. It's that the world changes in ways that are against civilization, free thinking, and objective truth. Politics determines language and language action, as Orwell warned. You can see this everywhere now. Premier Wetherill closes wards at Modbury Hospital. 30 of this hospital's doctors complain, citing response times, the level of treatment. Mr. Snelling suggests these doctors are only worried because they'd have to travel further north to, you know, Elizabeth. Completely untrue, but these are the sort of newspeak warriors that play with objective truth every day. I know whom I trust more, the man with my kidneys in his hand. But the lies are passed on via Winston Smith and his reliable scissors at the Ministry of Truth. Maybe that's why we writers keep scribbling, because we know the alternative. I digress. Sorry about that. It's good. It's not much more of it. It's only one or two. My next published book was a form of autobiography. 9-year-old Henry Page lives in Croydon, helps con the Greek at the Man Level Crossing, plays with his three friends next door. When his friends go missing one day, everything changes. The book was meant to be about what Australian neighbourhoods used to look like. what I could remember from when I was a kid. No one was any better than anyone else. Excess peaches were shared, kids played together until it was dark. This is not sentimental stuff, it's how I remember it. Things have changed. Gates, Jobs and the rest of them took care of that. So when we remember, is it just nostalgia or are we making important points? Is it that we can't, don't have the right or are unable to control what our lives look like? Time's Long Ruin was a book about childhood, but also how it's over so quickly or can be destroyed so completely by external forces. Epigraphs are powerful things. They only become useful after the book's finished, sometimes years later. Whitman summed up this book for me. Now we're talking about that one there. Walt Whitman said, this is an amazing quote, "They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death, and if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and ceased the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward, nothing collapses, and to die is different to what anyone supposed and luckier." And luckier. This intrigued me. Seemed the sort of statement you could only understand past a certain age, having experienced a range of disappointments, joys, ups and downs. This might have the effect of bringing you down. Samuel Beckett's Watt made this clear. I have to have a drink. This is really quick. Listen to this. Samuel Beckett, Watt. Has anyone seen Watt, the Beckett play? Beautiful, beautiful stuff. "Personally, of course, I regret everything. Not a word, not a deed, not a thought, not a need, not a grief, not a joy, not a girl, not a boy, not a doubt, not a trust, not a score, not a lust, not a hope, not a fear, not a smile, not a tear, not a name, not a face, not a time, not a place that I do not regret exceedingly." But most people learn to make the best of a bad lot. From the gas bill to another season of Kitchen Rules to death, which is sort of the same thing. But Whitman suggested that even death is lucky. After all, you can't be dead unless you are alive, which is generally a pretty okay experience, except for the times watching My Kitchen Rules. The idea that death doesn't wait at the end to determine to destroy, this seemed a wonderful idea and the novel a good way to explore it. The book sold well, was reprinted, translated into two languages, I'm gilding. Selected as the People's Choice novel for the National Year of Reading and was optioned for an opera which will premiere in 2017. It seemed to connect with people, at least locally, except, of course, for the Murdoch Press. The editor of which, one of Murdoch's favourite scaremongering disciples, set about convincing the population that an opera about missing children was tasteless, despite the fact that it's not an opera about missing children. Let's not let the facts stand in the way of a good story. Several commentators joined in the howling, determined, again in their best Joseph Goebbels style, to convince all of the decent people versus artists, people like me, all a bit sus, that the librettist, composer and whole company were somehow desecrating something sacred. I say the word Beaumont. They, of course, were entitled to beat every cold case up as they like, including spurious leads that would, indeed, cause great stress to families and survivors. Most creative artists see their job as making a version of the world. Readers can chew over, digest, incorporate, perhaps, in their own worldview. American artist Edward Hopper believed that's what he did, painting snapshots of the world he saw. Moments cherry-picked for their meanings, implications, potential to educate. In a recent documentary on Hopper, he explained how his approach to writing was best defined by Goethe, who said, "The beginning and the end of all literary activity is a reproduction of the world that surrounds me by means of the world that is in me. All things being grasped, related, recreated, moulded and reconstructed in a personal form and an original manner." That is one's own view of the world, mine, the melding streets of Hillcrest, dragsters and the weekly fight after school on the Beatty Road paddocks. Yes, I've travelled, seen other countries, cultures, people, but this is the one I understand. Reading, second reading, Time's Long Ruin. Okay, this is set in Croydon. Is anyone from Croydon? No, this is a suburb I lived in and know quite well. The next morning, this is Henry, the 9-year-old protagonist, our hero speaking. The next morning, I was woken by prayer. It was the usual gibberish in Wog coming from the pit of Ollie's front yard. I kicked off the sheets and crawled towards the open window at the end of my bed. I opened the Venetian blind and light streamed in. Through the roses, I could see the faithful gathered across the road at number 12, about a dozen of them. The pit of Ollie's would open their outdoor church for a single man or a whole suburb. The worshippers sat in two rows of chairs gathered in a semicircle around the healing tree, a monstrous old ash that bathed the street and several front yards in summer shade. In front of the worshippers, at the base of the tree, a few candles burnt on an altar about 3 feet high. On top of the altar was a picture of Alex Petavoli encased in a weatherproof frame made from glass and metal. Behind this was a large silver cross. Con's altar was made from leftover house bricks, rendered and encrusted in shells. Semaphore shells I'd given him after my beach visit. Over the years, wax from thousands of candles had melted over and down the side of the altar. It gave it an aged, miracle at Lourdes sort of look. Con had paved around his altar and left a raised step just in front of the faith for the faithful to kneel on. It had started off as an occasional thing. Rosa once told me that it all dated back to their first Croydon summer. It was March 1948. They'd only been in their new home a month. Con was out watering the front garden when he noticed the buds on the ash tree. Every day he watered them, slowly getting bigger and bigger, until 28 March, 6 years to the day since their son had died. Con got out of bed, hobbled to the window and looked out. "Come, look at this," he called to Rosa. She came to the window, took a deep breath and dropped to her knees. Then she started muttering something about Mary, Mother of Jesus and a front yard miracle. Con and Rosa went outside, still in their pyjamas, and knelt at the base of the tree, mumbling messages to God, the Virgin Mary and Alex Petavoli. So that's the sort of street we have in times long ruin. It's a very spiritual sort of street with very spiritual sort of people. So that was Time Long Ruin, and that's the one becoming the opera, if you're interested. It's written in full piano score, and in about a month's time, State Opera of South Australia are running the whole opera, and in about 12 months after it's orchestrated, it will be on their program for you to go see, hopefully. Oh, and they did say that although they had money to develop the opera at the early stages, they're now at the part where they've run out of money and they need someone for the next 12 months to pay for it. So if anyone's very wealthy here. From there to the whip. Self-flagellation. Have I got you interested? Not me, Percy Grainger. I've always had an interest in Grainger. He was born in Melbourne. He was a genius, studied at Frankfurt Conservatory by 14. He was playing around London in his late teens. He was flaxen-haired. He was a lover of Norse mythology. He was a believer in the blue-eyed. In short, a mass of contradictions. I've always loved his music. Small, well-designed and executed, mostly based on traditional folk song settings. Grainger was never an expansive, megamaniacal composer. Unfortunately today, Grainger is still known for many of the wrong reasons. All this rubbish about how close he was to his mother, wink wink, his love of the whip, true, although it wasn't like he was hurting anyone. If you go to the Grainger Museum in Melbourne, they have a collection of all his whips, by the way. You can see them. A Grainger-esque character appears in my next book, Dissonance. Oh, sorry, didn't bring that one. It's about a boy growing up in the Barossa again, a cut snake mother making him practice for hours a day, the idea that her love was conditional upon him becoming the greatest tickler of the ivories the world had ever known. Then they move to Europe, my version of Hamburg, as Hitler's war approaches. The settings move 40 years later from reality. Then the inevitable. He gets a girl pregnant. Mum hits the roof and one of the strangest fictional trios begins. I don't know what Grainger would make of it, but I do what he does. I take something interesting, some scraps of life, fiddle around with them and dish them up as something new. Perhaps that's all fiction is. Next was a crime novel. Wheatbelt was set in a town called Gilderton. This one here. There you go. Text Publishing, 2014. Wheatbelt was set in a town called Gilderton, but it was really an amalgam of Kadena and Jamestown. After a name change to One Boy Missing and an edit that removed a third of the book, it appeared thinned down, stripped of any subtlety, pimped as a quick read on the bus. I can say that because it's not Wakefield Press, it's text. Later, I regretted this, as the story hadn't been so much about the crime as the characters. But that, apparently, wasn't what the punters expected. This was a series of little compromises leading to bigger ones, which is why I haven't returned to the world of bodies and abuse, Jacko offering drugs to Inamika, etc., etc. All of which raises the question of the direction fiction is taking. Writers being convinced that genres are easier. Now readers have been trained to read early 2000s Scandi-noir crime with an existential bent, or upmarket 50 Shades with a postmodern perspective on gender roles. Right inside the box, which is the opposite of Joyce, avoiding the box altogether, or Max Sebald following his own intellectual meandering through the English countryside. Either way, my protagonist, 9-year-old Patrick Barnes, is found without parents, family, friends, indeed anyone who knows who he is. I like the question, can you have a crime if a crime hasn't been committed, if nothing's actually happened? But poor old D.C. Bart Moy, the name stolen from a list of Jamestown mayors from the 19th century. Sorry, I'm just not very good with names. D.C. Bart Moy manages to get Patrick talking and work out what's happened. Even then, it's an accidental crime. So maybe it's all about guilt, the fear of punishment, as this is, I guess, what Kafka was on about. Anyway, this was all a bit much for Kmart, so the angst was removed and I allowed it, much to my regret. Very quick reading here. This is a funny one. I thought by now you'd be depressed, so I'll give you a funny one. This is Bart Moy, the detective, goes to the local school to ask about this kid that's appeared. There's no crime. He doesn't know where this kid's from. He won't talk to him. So he goes to the local school and asks the local kids. He and the principal arrived in the gym. All 300 children were waiting for them, sitting on the ground in year-level lines. The youngest, their hands in the little valley of flesh created by their legs. The grade ones and twos, more alert, staring at the strange man beside Miss Downey. The threes and fours laughing and holding their nose because someone had farted. The older kids, their lines snaking across the floor at the back of the gym, their legs stretched out, whispered threats and promises passing up and down the line. Principal Downey waited at the front of the hall with her arms crossed. Eventually, over a minute or so, the students fell quiet. "Well, that was quite a wait," she said. "I don't understand why I should have to wait here for so long when it's obvious what I want you to do." Silence, as the teachers thought the same thing as the kids. "I've explained," she continued, "how it should be so quiet that I can hear the air conditioning." And they all listened, realising no one had turned it on. There was a boy staring at Moy with a scowl on his face. Moy glared at him, opening his eyes wide and clenching his jaw. The boy mouthed a word. Moy couldn't make it out. Was it please? Was he pleading for something? Perhaps he was saying his name. Peter, Paul, Pavlich. He said it again. Poof. Jesus, nothing changes. "Howard," the principal growled, and the boy looked forward. "The student council is meeting this Thursday. They'll be voting on four proposals put forward by you, the students." And she indicated, in case I'd forgotten who they were. Then she read from a clipboard. "One, soft drinks for the canteen." She looked up. Well, I don't know how that one got through. She smiled at an efficient-looking woman to her left. That wouldn't fit our healthy eating policy. And Moy wondered, if that were the case, why there were so many fat kids. He noticed a wall covered with sporting pennants dating back to the 1960s, boasting thirds, second and thirds for football, cricket, hockey and athletics. No pennants for netball. There were clubs for that. On his first day at high school, Rodney Elvis had given him the best advice of his life. "In your first sport lesson," the older boy had said, "make sure you put in zero effort." Why? "They're watching you. In your second lesson, they'll put you into groups and they make the advanced group run, play footy, do weights." And so it came to pass that by March, the advanced group was running circuits, jogging around the school and battling each other for the title of longest kick and quickest sprint. Meanwhile, the remedials were escorted to Jadell's pool room for an hour of snooker. "And now, Detective Sergeant Moy from the Gilded and CIB, is that right?" the principal asked. "Well, we don't really have a CIB as such," but she didn't care. "Mr. Moy wishes to speak to you, so best manners, no talking, or you might end up in handcuffs." He came forward. "I'd like to ask for your help," he began, and there were murmurs at the back of the hall. "Perhaps if you could speak up," the principal said. "Fine. Is that better? Can you hear me?" he asked. And one of the grade seven said, "Loud and clear, Detective." The whole group laughed. Downey stood glaring at them with her hands on her hips. A few of the other teachers stood up and started walking in the spaces between the rows. "Yesterday we had a report of an abduction from a laneway behind the shops on Air Street," and he explained. When he stopped, he noticed the poofter boy mouthing something different. "Gary? Gay? Get off? Gay? Gay? Yes, it was gay." The boy repeated it. "Sorry, what was that, son?" he asked, but the boy just looked down. "We think perhaps this boy didn't come to this school," Moy continued. "But we're wondering if anyone knows of a new boy that's been in town." Silence. "Someone new, maybe a relative, a cousin." More silence, a distant truck. "Maybe if you mention to your parents, you don't have to say anything now, you probably don't want to, but if you stay behind or speak to a teacher or Miss Downey," He let his eyes settle on the group and felt in control. Alternatively, he said, this boy may be sitting in front of me today. It may be that he was not taken, but has things going on at home with Dad or another relative, something Mum doesn't know about. Why was it his job, he wondered, to say these things? There was no point saying any more. They either knew what he meant or they didn't. So maybe it's not you, maybe it's a friend. And if you were a good mate, he let it hang, then looked up. Miss Downey? Thank you, Mr. Moy. She returned to the front and started telling the kids, what an exciting life a detective leads. Then the hands. In fact, I think I was meant to give the whole speech about this, and I've just got to it, but we're getting there. The hands. Thing is, I see stuff happening and I think, shouldn't someone be doing something? Or in my case, writing something. Steinbeck did this with The Dust Bowl, Grapes of Wrath, although James Agee and others wrote books at least as good. Having taught agriculture and lived in Kadena and other small towns, I learned about the connection farming families have to the land, or the way I described it in the book, quote, they, Trevor and his son, Trevor is the father and his son, Harry, stood and looked out across their farm. A light breeze moved through the grass. Trevor could sing its song through his cracked lips, feel it in his ears, his nostrils on his face. He pushed his dog-chewed hat onto his head, looked at his son, his expression full of an understanding that this was a place to be tamed, made to yield, more than his own intuition that it was nothing more than a sensation, the feel of sand in his boot. I can see how economics has made farming difficult for some, but more profitable for others. How the lack of rain tends to make the growing of wheat and other extensive crops difficult. How sheep and cattle like a drink too, and a bit of grass to eat. I see, how farmers can't always pop down to the local to drown their sorrows. How they live an isolated life, full of the consolations of a farming lifestyle, but also the challenges. Tried buying a harvester lately, a 2011 Case IH second-hand, 1,300 engine hours, $429,000. You can lease it if you like, but it's still an expensive proposition. Tractors, feed, seed, fertiliser, mortgage, school fees, and on and on. One half fails, two, three, maybe you're still okay. But a 10-year drought, longer, how's Dad feeling? How's Mum putting up with his moods trying to make ends meet and on, pardon me, on an off-farm job? And Pop, who had it all under control in his day. The average male suicide rate in Australia is 16.3 per 100,000, 23.8 in rural areas and 33.8 on farm. A series of factors combine to produce these statistics. Depression, stress, ill health, isolation, the inability to see or secure a way out of a seemingly hopeless situation. These are the extremes, but clues to the problems and the issues. I decided to create a family in the middle of a storm. Debt, falling stock prices, drought, falling stock numbers, and a father, Trevor, who's had enough. He'd like to sell Bundina, but his dad, Murray, won't have a bar of it. And there's the problem, the dilemma, the inability to change circumstances. Sell the place, find a house in town, give the kids a better education, socialise, go to a restaurant, feel happy about your life. The challenge was to make a hopeful book, and I think it is. There's a lot of arguing, castrating cattle that won't pay off a lifetime's debt, school-of-the-air lessons that don't seem remotely relevant to anyone, especially the kids. But only by seeing these things and examining the possibilities do the characters come to learn that no one is predetermined to do or keep doing anything. The lesson for all of us. We're out for a quick spin in an old Chrysler. We may as well put the top down, see what's over the next hill, and break the speed limit. Sorry if I'm getting too philosophical. James Agee's quote about Dust Bowl families appealed to me at the time of writing the book. In his Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, which is my desert island book. Has anyone read that? Oh, you have to read that. Beautiful book. He says about the Okies, which were the Dust Bowl people in Oklahoma in the 1930s. He says, in what way were we trapped? Where our mistake? New clothes, a great dollar and money in the bank. How did all of this sink so swift away, like that grand August cloud who gathers? As I thought, our grandparents had it harder, and theirs, and the struggle never stops. It just changes form. The constants are banks, always a cancer. The farmers, eternally hopeful, always working despite the clouds gathering just over the horizon. But newspapers and books are made in cities, so maybe people on the land have learned to do without the arrogance. There is always the forgotten view, the unreported view, the reported but ignored view. Even as our land is sold overseas, who cares? As long as there's milk in the bottle, does it matter who puts it there? Trevor Wilkie is father to 9-year-old Harry and 17-year-old Aidan. They live on the edge of arable Australia, grazing shorthorns very extensively. Everything is marginal: rain, feed, profits, income, relationships. Mum, Carolyn, tries to hold it together, but she must have some idea that her husband is deeply troubled, depressed, receiving no help in any real sense, in any emotional sense, from his father, Murray. Murray exists. I've seen a few. Writers steer clear of Murrays because they are, in a sense, one-dimensional, and we're always after three dimensions. But Murray is the sum of all the words and phrases that have ever been uttered to him, the looks he's got, the opinions he's perceived. And although unlikable, he is the story's key character because everything depends upon him. To describe Death of a Salesman's Willie Loman, quote, "I don't say he's a great man. Willie Maloman never made a lot of money. His name was never in the paper. He's not the finest character that ever lived. But he's a human being, and a terrible thing is happening to him, so attention must be paid." As indeed I tried to, presenting Murray as he was, no better, no worse. The kids try to like him but fail. His own son, his own sister, whose life Murray torments by tormenting her son, his nephew, a retarded boy named Chris. We all had a Chris in our street growing up, someone who we boys, the little bastards we were, cracked jokes about, although treated nicely because we knew we'd get our ass kicked if we didn't. Then we grew up, learned that the normality we took for granted was actually the exception, and that most people had troubles they had to deal with every day. Point being, Murray didn't even pretend to tolerate Chris. If he had have been a black sheep, he would have shot him, but he was, and he couldn't. Life churns out Murrays because life refuses to give some people the smallest chance of redemption. Then, of course, it's their fault because of the path they chose, the attitude they adopted. Like a worldview can be slipped on and off like a pair of jeans, but it can't. After about 20 or so, you're stuck with your own company. I had a vision of the hands becoming the next grapes of wrath, but it didn't, or hasn't yet, but it will after tonight, of course. I'd travel the country, speaking in libraries, bringing these issues to the fore, dragging reluctant farmers from their living rooms, but that hasn't happened. Perhaps it's my writing, or maybe books can't do the things they used to. Or maybe, and more likely, those same farming people are off doing what they've always done. Not reading, not talking, but trialling new crops, fixing the header, attempting another spreadsheet. That'd be good, but if the pressure continues, might they end up where the Wilkies were anyway, despite all of their best efforts. Perhaps what's really needed is a wider discussion. Newspaper, Probus and Lyons, Murdoch's lot, if they can stop going on about miracle diets for 10 minutes. Politicians. Only time will tell. But the model that worked so well in the past doesn't so much today. The main street of country towns, a buzz on a Saturday morning, lined with police signs. And I doubt the future will be selling off farms to giant agri-corporations who run monster tractors over thousands of acres of corporatised land or run thousands of cattle in feedlot. The future will always be with the farmer, Trevor Wilkie, finding a way to get by as the shark circle. And a very brief reading here, because I know if you're like me, you need to go to the toilet. This is a drive. The land was crusted, drying before it was used or presented as some sort of offering to the humans and small animals who attempted to live on it. Trevor drove, his hands held tightly 10-2 on the steering wheel. He tried to imagine this land as a map, its blue line major roads, black hatch highways, small dot towns and red spot cities. He tried to imagine how it had been scrawled upon, by and dissected, measured and claimed in the name of civilization. Carolyn, his wife, was sitting beside him, staring across the highway. "Where do you want to stop?" he asked, but she told him to keep driving towards Port Augusta. Harry was sitting in the back listening to headphones, singing and saying, "Mein Vater hat ein großes Auto." Trevor looked at him in the rear vision mirror, eh? Although he knew what it meant, knew each of the dozen or so phrases he kept repeating when he was bored. Harry met his eyes and he took off his headphones. "What? Mein Vater? Mein Vater hat ein großes Auto. My father has a big car." "Ja, is that all you know? Ich habe keine Schwester, aber ich habe einen alteren Bruder." Trevor studied the long grey strip in front of them. He followed it halfway to the horizon before it was consumed by haze. By then it was blood red, pulsing and shifting across the desert. He could tell it was alive, held in place by nothing more than a million distance markers. There were saltbush and blue bush and dead shrubs that looked the same as the living ones. A rest stop with a single bin, but nothing else, as if this too was some forgotten skeleton. He reached over and turned up the radio.
There were smaller numbers of illa steers, with most selling for feeder activity. Carolyn looked at him. Christ, are we going to listen to that? Harry stared at the road up ahead. Was ist das? He asked. But they were already over a dead roo. Trevor turned down the radio and looked at his wife. It's how we make our living, he said. She didn't reply, just found a magazine in the glove box, opened it and pretended to read. We've never been careful enough with prices, he said. What do you mean? But he just ignored her, turning up the radio again. Yearling steers sold mainly from 190 to 256 cents. Timing, he explained. Market fluctuations. We should be looking at the long term. Still, perhaps I don't give a shit. What? She looked at him. We're never going to be millionaires, are we? He ground his hands into the wheel, although it'd be nice to get out of debt. We will. She put the magazine down as a sign of solidarity. Perhaps we could find a buyer. Who's going to buy us out? Someone, one of these capital companies. But they both knew there was no point having this discussion again as long as Murray was alive. So, in the meantime, he asked, you worry too much. Someone has to. She pulled a baby face. Snookums. Fuck off. He switched off the cattle report. Sell the place then. Yeah, it's that easy. It gives us some idea of the dynamics in the beginning. Anyway, that's me up to date. I suspect, like Trevor, my writing time is limited by the economics of the industry. I still send work off and people still don't bother replying. It's a game we've been playing for decades. Like I said, either I stink, which wouldn't actually bother me so much, or I seem to be congenitally unaware of what the reading public really wants. But that's okay. Like Salinger, I'll retreat, write my books, this is my theory, place one on top of the other in my desk drawer, and when I fall off the perch, someone can clean the lot out, look at them and say, he really was a deluded bastard, wasn't he? Then they can carry the lot out into the backyard and set a match to them. I invite you all to attend, a keg will be provided, and one of Beethoven's late string quartets. It'll be nice, the word's free at last. Thank you. Go over.
Well, that was fabulous. And before you get to take out your checkbooks and your credit cards, which I know you're going to do, a few questions for Stephen.
Should I start with one? Should I pose my... Yes.
You said you were born... You were brought up in Croydon. Obviously, you've got a lot of experience about the country as well. So.
I lived in Croydon for a while, but I was brought up in Hillcrest. I suppose what I'll... Yeah, I did... Yeah, I used to be an... Years ago, I taught agriculture, so the knowledge I got for this came from working with sheep and cattle and, you know, cropping and so forth. Nonetheless, I think in terms of where I set the book, which was in the far west of the state, that sort of extensive cropping environment, my knowledge was limited, and I was very conscious of that when I wrote it, that I wanted to leave out anything I was unsure of. So if there are any farmers, they will probably pick fault with the book. But what do you do?
I was really impressed by dissonance. I got the sense you knew a lot about music.
Yes.
Are you a musician? Because I know nothing about music, but I was totally convinced.
Oh, okay. As I said, I really don't stick to much in life, so I did a science degree, decided I didn't want to do that, and I went and started a music degree at the Elder Conservatorium, and I did a year with Graham Kerner, who's, I think, still teaching composition there, and I suppose what I wanted to write was musical theatre, and I just worked out that really wasn't the direction, but I did pick up a lot of music. I wrote a review called Vocations, which is a musical review. My friend Greg here also co-starred in that 26 years ago, and I tried that out, but I sort of worked out, unless you're willing to get over into the big lights and really slog it out, it's probably Adelaide's not the place to forge a career in musical theatre. Could be wrong, I don't know.
Stephen, who's writing the music for that band? For the Times
Well Ruined. Who's writing the music? So Anna Corse, C-A-W-R-S-E, yeah. And the libretto was by Adam Goodburn. And Andy Packer from Slingsby is directing. And there's various other people involved, along the way. But it's coming along nicely. But it really is at the point where the actors are on the stage, the music's there, it's ready to go. Once the orchestration's done, but I suppose there'll be a lot of costs in terms of final production.
What do you teach now?
English, mainly now. But as I said, I've taught math, science, biology, agriculture. I've had a crack at everything, basically. I don't know if I'm any good at anything, but I just keep having a crack.
Do you
It's the thing is, you're sitting in the staff room and someone's preparing a lesson next year for another subject and you think, well, it doesn't look so hard. So you put your hand up. Probably parents wouldn't react in such a generous manner, but anyway, what do you do?
How long did it take you to write this one?
The hands? I still, up to that point, I was still writing longhand, so I'd spend a good 6 months writing longhand and then walk away and come back and type it up and then go through drafts, you know, electronic drafts at that point. So probably that whole process, maybe 2 years. But now I've just started not writing longhand as a first draft. I just physically can't do it. My hand's just, you know, if you're writing 130,000 words, it's too much on your hands. So I just type things up as a first draft now. But it took a little while, and it wasn't heavily edited, which was good. Another good thing about Wakefield, I don't have one of those. I hope no one knows. I won't say her name. But some publishers really say, if you want us to publish this, there will be significant cuts. And you do find yourself in this sort of self-hate mode where it's like you're taking out stuff you really thought was important and was really good and really did inform people about the character. They might think it's irrelevant, but it informs about the character. And you feel the obligation to do it. And that's something I've never had at Wakefield. But Alan and Unwin published my first book that was, again, quite heavily edited. So it seems to me the more commercial, the more market, the more genre, the more they're trying to put it into a box, the more it has to be chopped and to fit into the box, which is not the great contradiction for writers right now, I think, is do I become a commercial writer and get in the box before they ask me to get in it? Or do I just do what I want and struggle to find a publisher, I think, to me.
But what's your writing process?
Are
you a morning writer?
Well, as I said, I started writing 20 years ago, and I came here and I went down to the medical library and I just, that was it. I would have thought, I would have hoped all these years later, I'd like to get to the point where writing, I haven't arrived. And sort of frankly, the economics of writing books, I can't see that it'll ever happen. It's so hard and so competitive to get the few small grants that are out there to actually get it. I've never won for Barbara Hanrahan Fellowship. I'm not sucking around for sympathy. But I'll state facts. I've been applying for the main $15,000 fellowship, the state government, since 2001. I've never once got it. I've been applying for writing grants. I've never once got one. And I continually see people who don't have a publication record getting money. And I'm just thinking there's something terribly wrong with the way we're giving money out. So I struggle with work. I find that easier to go to work, earn the money, I know what I've got, and I'm getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning still 20 years later to try and do it. I wish it weren't so, but it is. So.
That's tragic. Mm. Can I ask a question about the 9-year-old boys? Did something cataclysmic happen to you as a 9-year-old boy?
Have you seen Federico Fellini's 8.5?
9.5.
Yes. So his idea, as with mine, is that... What's going on at 9 is probably the best that's ever going to be going on in your life.
Yes.
And I sort of wondered about that. Yeah, it's a very open... Yeah, it's just that particular age. I think it's just a coincidence that both of those were 9-year-olds.
But all your 9-year-olds are kind of heroes, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess they are. They're sort of troubled heroes.
Yes.
They're slightly autobiographical, I guess.
They've stepped up.
Yeah. There are some nasty things happened to a few of my... child heroes, and none of that happened to me. I had this sort of, as I said, I had Malvern Star drags to riding around Hillcrest, and that was the extent of my problems in life. And my mother, who's made an appearance tonight. So, yeah, we just come home to our braised steak and it was good. That was it, basically. I would sort of turn that on. My books are about families.
Yes,
yeah, it's about families and family dynamics, and they can't, if they were terribly well-adjusted, happy families, that would be terribly boring books, yeah. So, yes.
Is success to you, like your short list, your long list of Miles Franklin, if say, you won the Man Booker, but you still couldn't work full-time, would you feel like you were a successful writer because
you were
appreciated, or is it more about...
Absolutely. I learned many years ago that nobody's take on what I do is relevant. It's only what I think of what I've done and how well I think I've achieved it. Yeah, what means success to me is that I get to the end of a book and I had all these ideas and the way it might go and I kept changing it and it came out and I fixed all the problems with it, and there it is. And quite frankly, once I finish and hand it over, I'm ready for the next book. Wow. And, you know, people have their opinions, and people show me good reviews and the occasional not-so-good reviews. And the not-so-good reviews, as long as they're constructive, I just think. But even the really bad, there's a few axe-grinder-type reviews, I call them. And I just think they're generally from the more commercial publications that have very short reviews. And, you know, I think one person said about this, good reading, which have like 100-word reviews on a book. How can you have 100 words on a book? That's ridiculous. And he said, oh, the plot holes were so big you could drive a harvester through them. And it's like I spent so long with the publisher making sure there were no plot holes. You could go back. It's a very discombobulated book, but if you go back and make a timeline, it all makes sense, you know. And just because that person couldn't work it out on a very brief reading, therefore I deserve their bile. So it's sort of like, you know, whatever.
Well, I think that we are at the end of the evening, so I'm going to have to draw it to a close. But I think that you've got to love Peter Gers. He said you were South Australia's finest novelist.
Yeah.
Wow.